All right, there we go. So, welcome to the Scottsdale Big Book Study, where we will study the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today's date is Saturday, March 16th, 2024. My name is Veronica C., and I'm a recovered compulsive overeater from New York. I will be your host for today's study. And our co-hosts are Dottie and Nancy J. with Q&A. If you have any questions during the meeting, please contact either myself or any of the co-hosts by a private message in the chat function. The chat function will be disabled until 5 minutes before the Q&A answer session. Please note that Speaker Harlan G. will be recorded for the duration of the study. However, the Q&A session, which follows, will not be recorded. We ask if you can please make sure to keep your microphone on mute at all times during today's study. And also, please turn off your video if you are exercising, eating, or if you need to step away from your screen for any reason. During this meeting, we will post the link to our seventh tradition. This money will go towards the cost of our Zoom account, the cost of uploading our recordings, and we also need contributions for our intergroup and WSO. We will post a link to the previous week's recordings. These are available by clicking on the link that will be posted in the chat box. And now I will turn this over to Harlan. Take it away.
Thank you very much, Veronica. Thank you. And thank you for your service. Thank you to all the people who make this possible and to the people who make putting the podcasts on the internet possible. That was something that was a brainchild of Lauren N. And she was the one who got us started. And I was just talking the other day, Wednesday, how I never saw this coming. I mean, I thought this would be something we would do during the pandemic. I thought it would be like a flu thing, you know, and within a few weeks, we'd be back to live meetings and live contact and live stuff. And there we were, there, here we are 4 years later. And the other day was March the 13th. And March the 13th was the first day, it was a Friday. March the 13th in 2020 was a Friday. And I had been to a live meeting at the North Scottsdale Fellowship Club the night before, which was Thursday the 12th. That would be the last live meeting that I would attend for a very long time, because that Friday, from morning until night, the networks, the newspapers, the radio, the internet, all it was coronavirus, coronavirus. It wasn't even COVID yet. It was called at that time, coronavirus. And what's funny is everybody stopped drinking Corona beer and their sales went to nothing. And so they had to sort of weather the storm that Corona beer and coronavirus were two completely different things, that they were not in any way, shape or form, the same thing. And then little did we know that we would be dealing with this for far longer than at least I could have ever seen. And we went from a phone meeting into this thing called Zoom. And now it's the 16th of March, and it is 4 years later, and we are still here. We are still using this format, which is just incredible. And we always want to thank Lauren. She's not here, but we want to thank Lauren and who saw this from the beginning. She says, we've got to get this on Zoom. And Zoom was a noise little boys made when they were playing with cars or playing with trucks. Zoom was a noise that you made when you were a very young boy and you had your little tricycle and you'd ride your tricycle through there and go, Zoom, Zoom, Zoom. I never knew what Zoom was. Well, now, of course, I do know what it is. And I've certainly gotten a wonderful education in Zoom and all this other stuff in the last few years. But it is now 4 years, almost to the day, March the 13th, 2020, that the first day occurred that I did not attend a live meeting, and many of us did not. So, yeah, it's just incredible how quick 4 years goes by. I will also share with you, since a lot of you were asking, I had a stress test on my heart. I'm going to be 70 years old at the end of May. And my heart, with all the assaults on it that I, you know, mounted with Chips Ahoy and Almond Joy and all this other crap that I ate over the years, you know, Egg McMuffins and all this other French fries and stuff, my blood flow in and out of the heart is normal. And I'm just going to stay on my medication, and there's no significant blockages there at all whatsoever. So I am just as grateful today as I can be. I am in awe of the power of God, and I am in awe of the power of the program that we are endeavoring to work to the best of our abilities. So I am just a very, very lucky guy, lucky guy. My apologies to the people in Arizona who now have to get up a little earlier on Saturday, because now until October, I think it is, we are going to be in Arizona doing this an hour earlier, so that everybody who's not in Arizona does not have to change their time. So we're starting this an hour earlier in Arizona than we used to. We have been talking about Bill's story, and when we get started, we're going to get started on page 13, at the hospital I was separated. And what we're going to do this morning is we're going to walk with Bill as he quickly and efficiently goes through the steps. And one of the things I see so often in OA is I see sponsors protracting out the length of time that it takes people to get through the steps. We're going to see this morning how Bill goes through the steps quickly rather than slowly. It is very important. And we're going to see that he doesn't do a bunch of written assignments. He doesn't do a bunch of ancillary readings, things like that. He's going to go through using what he knew from the Oxford group movement, because at that time, there were no 12 steps. 12-step program didn't exist. So he's going to use what he has from the Oxford group, which was brought to him by Ebby. And between the end of November and the middle of December, he is going to start, albeit he is drunk, he is going to start attending Oxford group meetings. So we're going to see how he moves through the work. But before we do, as is my wont, we are going to just back up a little bit and review where it is we're endeavoring to start today. We are in Bill's story, and we have given you the history of step two. And the history of step two is brought to us by Ebby Thatcher. Now, that's a very simplistic statement, because if Roland hadn't had money to go to Switzerland in the heart of the Depression, 1931, he goes to Switzerland and he places himself unreservedly under the care of Dr. Jung. J-U-N-G is Jung, pronounced Jung, not Jung or Jung, but Jung. If he didn't have the money, the message wouldn't have got here, because in Switzerland, just to review, Roland is going to get a ray of hope. See, Dr. Jung looks at Roland and he says, "You're a hopeless alcoholic. I've misdiagnosed you. You're going to die. You are going to have to place yourself under lock and key or die." And Roland begs Dr. Jung, "Is there no alternative to this?" And Jung broke rank with Roland's first two choices at psychotherapy, when Roland wanted to go into psychotherapy in 1930, he asked Freud to take him, Freud wasn't taking on any patients. He asked Adler. Adler was the number two man in psychotherapy. He asked Adler to take him on, and Adler wouldn't take him. So he went to the third choice. Now, is it odd or is it God? Is it odd or is it God that he didn't get to Freud or Adler? Because had he got to Freud or Adler, we'd be sitting around psychoanalyzing ourselves, because Freud and Adler believed that all solution lie within the mind, within the cerebral. And that was their theory. And Jung broke rank with Freud and Adler, and he believed that here and there, there were people who could be helped by a spiritual experience. And I know the question is going to come up, so I'm going to answer it now. What is the difference between a spiritual experience and a spiritual awakening? A spiritual experience, like we're going to see Bill having this morning, we're going to talk about Bill's spiritual experience. And a spiritual awakening is what I have, and that is, it's slow in developing. It is, my spiritual awakening is of the educational variety. When I learn, I get deeper entrenched into my dependence and adoration of God, and I feel his adoration for me. I feel it today. I feel today like he loves me more than he did yesterday. When I was a kid, there was a song by Spiral Staircase. It was called, "I love you more today than yesterday, but not as much as tomorrow. And I love and need God more today than I did yesterday, but not as much as tomorrow." Because as my disease progresses, I need God more and more and more, rather than less and less and less. And I love doing my step 11s in the morning. I have a partner that does the step 11 with me. And I just feel like it not only brings us closer together, but I think that by doing it with another person who I adore, it brings me closer to God, who I need and love. I believe that it is a very special kind of work that we do. It's just fabulous. And what we're going to just review before we get started on today is this. Step two comes into the program because Roland, who I just talked about, told this information to Ebby, him and Sieber Graves Jr. If you remember, Sieber Graves Jr. was in East Dorset. He lived in East Dorset, Vermont, but he was in New York. He was at the Oxford Group. And Sieber Graves Jr. and a guy by the name of Shep Cornell were alcoholics within the Oxford Group at the Cavalry Mission in New York. And Sieber Graves Jr. and Roland went to the judge in Vermont, who was going to remand Ebby because of drunk and disorderly and drunk driving. There was no crime for drunk driving in the 1930s. He was considered drunk and disorderly. Isn't that something? There was no crime for driving intoxicated during that time. That came about much, much later, which we won't get into because it's an outside issue. But I'm just letting you know, there was no crime for that at that time. Isn't that something? But anyway, he was considered drunk and disorderly, and Ebby was going to be remanded to Brattleboro, which is a town in Vermont. I actually ate lunch there with my sponsor and some friends when we visited Bill's home years ago. But he was going to be remanded to the Brattleboro Insane Asylum in September of 1934. And Roland Hazard and Sieber Graves Jr. asked the judge, whose name, wait for it now, whose name just happened to be Sieber Graves Sr. So it was son and father, and the father said, yes, if Ebby will go with you, I will remand him to your care, And then you can take him to New York with the stipulation that if he doesn't do what you say, he will be immediately extradited back to Vermont and he will go to the insane asylum in Brattleboro. That's what they did with alcoholics at that time. They locked you up. There was nothing else they could do. And Bill was about to get locked up too, because Silkworth was telling Lois that after his second hospitalization, his being Bill's, that Bill was going to have to either go to the cemetery or the insane asylum. And he says he almost welcomed the idea because he had no more fight left in him. That's how bereft he was, bereft of any type of method of combating this alcoholism. It was getting worse and worse right in front of his eyes. And Bill knew the problem. He got the problem from Silkworth. What is the problem? The problem of alcoholism is a twofold problem. Number one, it is a problem of the mind that you are seeking to get the effect, and your brain loves that effect. Dr. Silkworth will say in his opinion, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That effect is not inebriation. When alcoholics are drinking for that effect, they're not drinking necessarily because they like being drunk. They like that sense of ease and comfort that comes over them when they're drinking. And they get that effect after maybe one or two drinks. But most alcoholics are not drunk after one or two drinks. So it's not the inebriated state that they seek. It's that sense of ease and comfort that comes over them. And that sense of ease and comfort, called the effect, instantly alters their perception of reality. When I am feeling sad, mad, glad, jealous, scared, frustrated, an almond joy will change instantly my perception of reality. Now, with that in mind, that almond joy will change my perception of reality, I'll use M&Ms because they're easier. M&Ms are easy to see, to visualize. If all that food did, that chocolate did, was give me that effect, I would keep them. I would wear like a Batman utility belt, and I would keep M&Ms, of course, with peanuts in that utility belt. And if I was feeling mad or sad or glad or what have you, I would take an M&M with peanuts, of course, and I'd pop it into my mouth like a Xanax, like a whatever. And I would feel great and I would go on with my day. But that mental part of this disease is just half my problem. And Dr. Silkworth writes in the doctor's opinion, he says, any description of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. What is that physical factor? The physical factor is what Dr. Silkworth calls the allergy of the body, the physical craving. Here is something that never happened to me. Isn't that a weird sentence? Here's something that never happened to me. I don't even know that that's grammatically correct, but here is something that has never happened to me. I have never eaten one M&M without a desire that would make me walk through walls to get to more. I have never eaten one M&M without a strong desire to eat 20 more of them. And then after I eat 20 more of them, I'm going to eat 50 more of them. And the more M&Ms I eat, the more I want. And the more I want, the more I eat, the more I eat, the more I want. And it's just endless. It's just endless. And so it becomes impossible for me, as a sufferer of compulsive overeating, to both control and enjoy my food. When I'm controlling it, I cannot enjoy it. When I enjoy it, I cannot control it. I am powerless over food. I am checkmated by this disease. I can't eat because of the allergy. I can't keep away from food because of the twist of the mind. And so I am checkmated by this disease. I am defeated by this disease. Now, Bill knew all of that information. You remember when he tells us in his story, he says on page, he says it would relieve me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. So now he understands that self-knowledge is not going to get him anywhere. Just the knowledge of what this is not going to help me. I have to have a remedy. So let's take a look at what happened before we're going to get started today. We're going to, again, get started on page 13 at the top of the page at the hospital. Ebby, because Roland told Sebra and Roland told Ebby. Ebby is now telling Bill about his solution, but Ebby doesn't know the problem. Ebby doesn't know about the physical allergy. He doesn't know about the twist of the mind. All Ebby knows is he's doing this program and he's not drinking. That's all he knows. He doesn't know anything else. Now, the confluence of two rivers makes a third river that's always stronger than the tributaries. The tributaries form a stronger river. So let's take a look at page 12 for just a second in review. And we're going to see how Ebby, you know, tells him, why don't you choose your own conception of God? I'll give you a little AA history. You got to promise not to tell anyone. Ebby never said that. Ebby never said, why don't you choose your own conception of God? Because Ebby was coming out of a Christian group, the Oxford group, which was practicing first century Christianity to the best of their ability. Now, Ebby may have said something about that, but that idea of choosing your own conception of God really came from Jimmy Burwell. It didn't come from Ebby. And so Ebby for decades maintained, I never said that, but in the late, now don't tell anybody this because I'm giving you secret information here. In the late 50s, Ebby couldn't make a living. He had been drunk and sober and drunk and sober, and he was kind of a sardonic kind of guy. He was not easy to get along with, and so he was having a problem making a living, and Bill was making $2.2 million on average per year through the sale of the big book, As Bill Sees It, and the 12 and 12, and he started supporting Ebby financially, and when that occurred, Ebby stopped denying that he said that. He says, yeah, that's what I said, but that idea of why don't you choose your own conception of God really came from Jimmy Burwell, but don't tell anyone. That's going to be our little secret. Okay, so Bill says at the bottom of 12, thus was I convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want him enough. And notice that him is capitalized. At long last, I saw. What did he see? He saw recovery. See, Bill was in the hospital a couple of times before the third time that we're going to talk about today. He was in the hospital and he saw heavy drinkers, moderate drinkers, and alcoholics not drinking, but they weren't happy about it. Well, Ebby was happy in his release. So he saw recovery. He says, I felt. What did he feel? He felt hope. He felt the hope that maybe if he was going to do what Ebby was doing, that he too could be emancipated from the tyrant alcohol. And the last thing he says is, I believed. What did he believe? And this will be repeated on page 61. It says, he says that God could and would if he were sought. I saw recovery. I felt hope. I believed that God could and would if he were sought. So we have a tremendous epiphany on the part of Bill Wilson. It is a tremendous epiphany here. It is unbelievable, and it is going to change the world as we know it, because it is at this moment in time when Bill says, "A scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. A new world came into view." Scales of pride and prejudice. What pride that he could do the job himself. What prejudice that this God was absolutely now going to help him. He believed it because he saw it. And Bill knew that Ebby was an alcoholic. God sent the perfect messenger. God is always perfect. God is always on time. And God is perfect. Bill could not have sent a better messenger, because Bill said throughout his life, Bill started drinking in 1917, and he quit drinking, well, we're going to see that, in 1934. 17 years of Bill's 30-some years of life were spent drunk as a skunk. But he said many times, if I ever get to be as bad a drunk as Ebby, I'm going to quit. And he also said that if I ever get to be as bad a drunk as Bill, I'm going to quit. So the bottom line is, Bill used the perfect example, the perfect messenger to get this message through. At long last, I saw. What did he see? He saw recovery. He felt. What did he feel? Hope. What did he believe? That God could and would if he were sought. And it was at this moment. It was at this moment in time, in November of 1934, after thousands and thousands of years where alcoholics and drug addicts, yes, they had drug addicts way back, yes, and any person addicted to anything would just die in their addiction, and there was nothing known to do for them. Now there's a hope. Now there's something that can be done. Let's go to the top of 13. Bill is going to enter the hospital on the 11th of December, 1934. On December 11th, 1934, Bill Wilson is going to attend a meeting of the Oxford Group. However, he is drunk. And he makes a decision on the 11th of December, 1934, with a bottle of gin in his hand that he is now waving at Dr. Silkworth in the hallway of the hospital, that he is going to go back to the hospital and quit, and he is going to join the Oxford Group, and he's going to overcome his alcoholism with God's help. And Bill Wilson will stay sober on the 12th and the 13th of December. So he's answering a question. How long do you have to be abstinent before you can work the steps? 2 days. We're going to see other references to this 2 days. Bill will go in drunk on the 11th, and on the 12th and the 13th, he will be sober. On the 14th of December, 1934, exactly 60 years before my daughter would be born, on the 14th of December, 1994, Bill Wilson will wake up sober. And Bill Wilson will now do what we know today as the 12 depths of Alcoholics Anonymous. But at that time, there were no 12 steps of alcoholics anything. So what he is going to embark on is he is going to embark to do the 12 tenets of the Oxford Group movement. Now, I'm going to tell you what they are, and the 12 tenets and the four absolutes, the six tenets of the Oxford Group. Number one, complete deflation. This is from page 263 in the fourth edition. 263 in the fourth edition is where this is coming from. Okay, so complete deflation. Two, dependence and guidance from a higher power. Number three, moral inventory. Number four, confession. Number five, restitution. Number six, continued work with other alcoholics, or what the Oxford groupers would say, give testimony. What do they mean when they say give testimony? Why was Ebby calling on Bill? To show Bill what Christ had done for him. Remember that the Oxford group were Christian in nature. They were not non-sectarian. They were not Alcoholics Anonymous. They were a Christian group. Okay, know that for our history. There were four absolutes of the Oxford group, and you had to work toward them using the tenets. There was absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. I'll give you those again. Absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. Those tenets became the basis for our steps today as we know them. Let's go to page 13 at the top. At the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. In other words, he wasn't drinking. Now, we get this question all the time. We get it at our Scottsdale meetings. We used to get it on Vision, because in Vision, you can't ask questions anymore. But we used to get it on Vision. We still get it when people call up. They say, do I have to be abstinent to work the steps? And I say, if you want to work them successfully, you do. I mean, there's no OA police that are going to come to your house and arrest you. But if you want to work the steps successfully, you must be abstinent. Otherwise, you won't need a spiritual experience or awakening. You'll have it from the pizza, you'll have it from the candy or whatever it is you're eating. So, okay, at the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. Delirium tremens are the shakes. You know, I used to live in Eugene, Oregon. Well, in Eugene, Oregon, there is no OA. There's no such thing. It doesn't exist. So I tried, they had a couple of meetings where there'd be like three people, four people, but it was just ridiculous. So I had to go to AA. And when I was in AA, I saw these guys, man, they looked like a wire hair fox terrier trying to crap out a peach pit. I mean, it was sad. I mean, these guys, you talk about a drinking problem. They couldn't even get the cup of coffee up to their mouth. Somebody'd have to help them, literally help them get that cup of coffee up to their mouth. And it was really sad, really sad. Okay. Now, this paragraph that we're going to read now is the first three steps as we know them today, and excuse me, the first four steps as we know them today. There I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him, to do with me as he would. Watch your capitalizations here when he capitalizes, unless it's the first word of the sentence or it's a proper noun, he's talking about God. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. Does that sound familiar? I admitted for the first time that of myself, I was nothing. I was powerless. That without him, I was lost. I ruthlessly faced my sins, step four, and became willing to have my newfound friend, capitalized, take them away root and branch. I have not had a drink since. So in this one paragraph, he is working steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, and 7. When he says, I ruthlessly faced my sins, that's step 4, and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away root and branch, that's step 6 and 7. So in that first paragraph, just to review, he has worked now what we know today as steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, and 7. Keep score at home because this is important. Now, he says, my schoolmate visited me. Let's stop right there. Let's stop right there. When Ebby came to see him in the hospital on the 14th of December, 1934, Ebby had a book under his arm. I have it. I have the book. It's in my living room right now. And the book is called The Varieties of Religious Experience. It was written by William James, and it will become one of the 4 books that will greatly frame the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, is the reason that you have the stories in the back of the book. It is a book that was written by William James, who was a psychologist. In 1901, there was a conference in Glasgow, Scotland, at the University of Glasgow in Scotland, and they had a conference of psychologists. And they told stories of people that they had treated. And they told the story of what they were like, what happened to these people, and what they're like now. Does that sound familiar? I hope it does. What they were like, what happened to them, and what are they like now? In other words, how did they find God? And that book is very important. It was extremely popular in the Oxford group at that time. And it will change everything too, because it is the reason that you have the personal stories in the back of the book. Let's get back. My schoolmate visited me and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. Step 5. We made a list of people I had hurt or toward whom I felt resentment. Step 8. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Step 9. Never was I to be critical of them. Step 10. Admitted our, you know, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I was to write all such matters to the utmost of my ability. So in these 2 paragraphs, he has worked what we know today as 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 5, 8, 9, and 10. In order, they would be 1 through 10. So he has worked the first 10 steps of the Oxford group movement in these first 2 paragraphs. And I hope that when you are a sponsor, that you will point out to your sponsees that he worked them quickly. He didn't work them slowly. He worked them quickly. Very, very important. If there's anything we need to do, it's to help people find God and to help them find him quickly. Very, very important. Now, the next paragraph is repeated, not verbatim, but in its ideals on page 87, because this step 11 is pure Oxford group. So Oxford group that when Hank Parkhurst read this page from Bill's manuscript, he put a circle around this paragraph and said, Bill, this is real groupy. Are you sure you want it in this way? When he says groupy, he means real Oxford group. But this paragraph is dripping with Oxford group. Let's read it and understand that it is repeated in its ideas on page 87. So let's see how close it tallies to page 87 in step 11. This is Bill taking step 11. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he, capitalized, would have me. Never was I to pray for myself, except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. What is he saying there? He wants God to help him be of service. He wants God's will in his life. He didn't want to sit there and say, please let me have a new bicycle. Please let, you know, whatever. Please let win the lottery, or please, you know, let my wife do this or don't do that, whatever it was. He is asking God for direction. He's asking God, not for himself, but so he can be of maximum service to God and the people about him. This paragraph is pure Oxford Group, and it is Bill taking step 11. Now, Bill is promised something. Let's see what the next paragraph says. My friend, who's his friend, Ebby, promised, when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems. Belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things, were the essential requirements. Now, Bill is going to go to sleep on the 14th, and he is going to awaken on the 15th after this paragraph. Simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. By working the first 11 steps, Bill sees how self-centered he is. When I did my first inventories, maybe the first 20 of them, I got a picture of how selfish and self-centered and scared, dishonest, angry I was. And if you would have asked me that, I would have said, no, that doesn't apply to me. Oh, yes, it does. And I saw through those inventories just how human I was. So Bill is saying, I must turn in all things to the Father of Light, capitalized, who presides over us all. He is now understanding something that a lot of people like me did not understand. I cannot give God my eating and hold on to my money. I cannot give God my eating and hold on to my love life. I cannot give God my eating and hold on to my career, or my relationship with my friends, or whatever that may be. I must turn to the Father of Light who presides over us all. And to the best of my ability, yes, I'm human, and yes, I sometimes try to figure things out, or I try to power drive my will through things. Yes, I do. I'd be a liar if I said I didn't. But if I'm successful in something, it is this. I have a heightened awareness that God is the answer, no matter what the question. That no matter what the question, from what should I eat today, to what should I wear today, to what leg should I put through the pants first, or what arm in the shirt first, God is the answer to every question. Whether I'm conscious of it or not, God is the answer. And it is vital to my survival that I understand that. And he's going to say, these were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. Now, he wakes up on the 15th of December with all this in mind. And he said, right up till the day he died, that a white light came into the room and it almost blinded him. And he thought he had gone crazy. He thought he was having an alcoholic delusion delusion or a dream or a fantasy. He was having a spiritual experience. Let's look at what he says. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. God had entered the room. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. Bill has now had a spiritual experience, and he has felt the presence of God. I feel subtle presence of God. I look at my life, and I know that my way of thinking, my way of acting would never have got me to the point where I am today. I don't have the knowledge or the power to get me where I need to be. But God does. I have a life today. Yes, I missed out on a lot. Oh boy. You all heard me rant and rave about that many times, but I have a life today that's worth living. I own my home. I mean, I pay a mortgage, but I own my home and I own my car. And I have a love life and I have friends and I'm healthy and I can walk 3 miles a day, 6 days a week. There are people who are my friends. I love them and they love me back. I have a life that includes people. I have a life that includes a lot of wonderment and miracles. And I have a life that works because of this program. Now, Bill Wilson is a selfish son of a bitch. He is a selfish son of a bitch to the max. He is an alcoholic. But after his spiritual experience, let's see where his brain goes. And he says here, for a moment I was alarmed and called my friend the doctor to ask if I were still sane. He thinks he's gone crazy. He listened in wonder as I talked. Silkworth was too good a man to tell him he was crazy. He said, finally, he shook his head saying, something has happened to you. I don't understand. But you had better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were. The good doctor now sees many men who've had such experiences. He knows they are real. And Dr. Silkworth changed the world too by convincing Bill that he had not gone crazy. He had not had a fantasy or delusion or alcoholic, paranoid dream. That what he was feeling was real, that God had come to him. Now, Bill Wilson is a selfish, alcoholic son of a bitch. By his own admission, he never gave much of a damn about anybody in his life. Let's see where the next paragraph takes us. While I lay in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might work with others. So for the first time in Bill Wilson's life, he is thinking about other people. He is thinking about how he is going to bring the message of what was brought to him into the lives of other suffering alcoholics. He is now going to think, how is he going to do that? And the last paragraph, or maybe not, but the last paragraph on that page is what I call Ebby's legacy. Now, I hear this all the time on our Scottsdale meetings, people who will not sponsor. They would rather look for ways to keep going through the steps and be the student and never the teacher. If you don't sponsor, you will not recover. I'm going to say that two more times because it's vital to your survival. If you don't sponsor other people, you will not recover. If you don't sponsor other people, you will not recover. Let's take a look at the next paragraph. My friend, Ebby, had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. What are the principles? The principles are the steps. A lot of people say, oh, the principle of this is hope, and the principle of that is honesty, and the principle of that is whatever. That's not what he's talking about. That came out years after Bill was dead. Bill just didn't want to keep using the same word over and over and over and over again. So he calls them steps. He calls them principles. He calls them guiding practices. Whatever he calls them, this is what he's talking about, is the steps. The absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative. What does imperative mean? It means important beyond all else. Important beyond all else. And he says it was imperative to do what? To work with others as he had worked with me. In other words, you better get your ass out there and sponsor. And that's why we work the steps quickly rather than slowly. You need to get to page 89 where it says, nothing ensures immunity from drinking like intensive work with other alcoholics. So the question gets raised, if you work the steps really slowly, will you probably die in the food? And the answer is most likely yes. Most likely yes, because you need to pass this on. Clancy Imeslin says, you do not learn this program by absorbing spiritual information. You get this program by transmitting spiritual information. Quite a difference. Faith without works is dead, was dead, he said. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life, how do you perfect and enlarge your spiritual life? Through work and self-sacrifice for others. He could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. If he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. This paragraph is key. What it is telling me is I better sponsor other people. I don't want to hear that you're doing taxes and you can't sponsor. I don't want to hear that you're going out of town. I don't want to hear that you're on vacation. I don't want to hear that. This disease doesn't take vacations. I don't care if you're doing taxes or you juggle chainsaws for a living. I don't care if you're a brain surgeon. I don't care who you are or what you are. If you do not make the time to sponsor, if you do not make the time to consider others first and help them find God, you will not recover. You're going out of town. Your disease doesn't go out of town. I don't want to hear people telling me my sponsor's out of town. Or my sponsor only lets me call 2-3 days a week. Who are you kidding? This disease will ransack your life. What are you doing? Why are you setting limits on your service? Why are you setting limits? How free do you want to be? I don't give a damn that you're doing taxes. I don't give a damn that you're a doctor or a lawyer or you're a whatever the hell you are. You dig ditches or you fix cars. I don't care. This disease will ransack your life and it will take you to places you never dreamed were this horrible. Because however horrible this disease has treated you, there's worse in front of you if you don't do this work. That'll seem like a walk in the park compared to what you're going to get if you don't do the work. So this paragraph is very clear. It says, and I quote, "Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me." It doesn't say on weekdays. It doesn't say just on, you know, weekdays or weekends. It says work with others. That means any day that ends in a Y. Any day that ends in a Y. So let's get off the BS train and let's get in the ball game and let's sponsor every day. Let's do what we need to do. What are we talking here? Digging ditches, fixing toilet? What are we talking here? We're talking about taking a phone call. You had the time to call for the pizza. You had the time to call for the groceries. You had the time to call the ice cream parlor or the chicken place or whatever. You had the time to do that. Now we're asking you to make time to help someone not do it. We're not asking you to clean toilets at the airport. We're not asking you to dig ditches. We're asking you to take phone calls. What could possibly be so horrible? And yet every single day I get this call. I don't want a sponsor. No, you don't want to not be the perfect sponsor. That's what you're afraid of. You're afraid you're not going to be perfect. Well, I'll let you in on another secret. Nobody's the perfect sponsor. Nobody. Do the best you can. Some will recover, most will not. Do the best you can. Some will recover and most will not. And you know what people are going to think of you? Nothing. Nothing. We're all so wrapped up in what people think of us. Guess what? They're not thinking about us at all. Not even a little bit. They're going to think nothing. You just keep doing the best you can. You think when we sponsor, those of us who are not you, you think 100% of the people I sponsor recover? I wish that was the case. I wish that was the case. Let's do another paragraph and we'll be done. My wife and I abandon ourselves with enthusiasm. There's a good word. Enthusiasm comes from two Greek words, entheos, from God, to the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution of their problems. It was fortunate for my old business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half, during which I found little work. I was not too well at the time and was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink, but I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Are you working with other people? If you're not, you're in trouble. Many times I'd gone to my old hospital in despair. I'm talking to a man there. I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It is a design for living that works in rough going. Now, this is very, very important. And we have to see this for what it is. It is an instruction manual. He's not talking about him. He's talking about what we need to do. It is very, very vital that we sponsor. We have to sponsor or die. It's very, very vital. You won't sponsor, you will not recover. Okay, I'm going to turn this back over to someone. I think Veronica, if I'm not mistaken. I'm going to turn this over to Veronica. Next week, we're going to finish Bill's story, and we are probably going to start Chapter 2, There Is a Solution. That was the first chapter written. The first chapter written was There Is a Solution. But it became Chapter 2 after a series of situations that I'll tell you about next week. Okay. No math. And please, no food questions. It's a waste of time. It's a complete waste of time to sit here and ask me food questions. Okay, I'm going to turn it back over to Veronica.